days. Frank had pulled permits from public county records and nursing licenses from the Illinois Department of Professional Regulation. He made phony phone calls to inquire about the hospital's services and had pieced together an impressive biography of Margaret Schreiber. "She left Bayer Group on her 18th birthday," Frank said into the phone. "I found the woman who picked her up."
"It wasn't her parents?"
Thomas Mitchell asked in a static-filled voice from prison.
"No. She signed herself out, but a woman named Margaret Schreiber helped her. It's my only lead so far. The only non-family member whom I can link to her before she met you. I'm running with it for now."
"Have you talked with her?"
"Briefly," Frank said.
"Did you ask about Angela?"
"I mentioned her."
"And? You think she knows something?"
Frank remembered Margaret Schreiber as she backpedaled through the front door of her farmhouse. He remembered the fear in her eyes. He remembered the curtains as they shifted slightly when the woman peeked through the window as he drove away. She was hiding something, and Frank had a good idea what it was.
"I'm not sure," he finally said. "But when I know more, I'll be in touch."
Frank hung up the phone and logged the 15-minute call to the Thomas Mitchell file and tacked it onto the appeals billing. His secretary walked into his office.
"I'm heading to lunch," she said. "Here are your messages from the morning."
She held yellow slips of paper in her hand.
"Your wife called. She's going to work early and won't see you tonight. Howard Garrison stopped by, wants you to come see him. And a strange message from someone who wouldn't give her name."
She said, "Hold on, it was a bit strange."
Frank felt a numbness run through him as the secretary shuffled the paper slips.
"Here it is. She said..."
Frank's secretary looked up from the message to stare at him with raised eyebrows.
"Sorry about the dogs, and she'd like to talk with you as soon as possible."
The secretary handed him the message.
"You know what that's all about?"
"Long story,"
Frank said, standing quickly and hurrying around his desk.
"I'll call my wife later. Tell Mr. Garrison I got hung up with something. I'll see him tomorrow."
"She wouldn't leave a phone number,"
the secretary said as Frank hurried out of the office.
"That's okay. I don't need one."
He jogged out of his office, chasing the ghost of a woman who disappeared 2 years ago. Chapter 24. Chicago, October 30th, 2019. After Rory's mother, Marla, died 6 years earlier, her father had threatened to downsize to a condo but could never bring himself to do it. Instead, he kept the three-bedroom house where Rory was raised and lived in the too large space in order to keep the memory of his wife alive. It dawned on Rory the night before that, with her father gone, she'd have to empty the place like she had done the law office, box everything up and stick a for sale sign in the front lawn. After too many dark lords, she had lain on the sofa with a strong beer buzz. She contemplated the sad and unenviable task of clearing out her childhood home of all its memories, to allow a different family to start the process of painting a new story over the ones that were here now. She had contemplated it all while using the alcohol to numb her senses. Eventually, she dozed off and was gone to the world. Rory woke now in her father's office. Sunlight skewed through the window and across her face, causing her to shield her eyes as she woke. A dull headache greeted her as she sat up on the couch and rubbed her temples. Her father had died in this room. It was where Celia had found him, and Rory felt some cathartic sense of peace for having stayed here through the night. Maybe she offered her father's spirit a night of company. Maybe she was still drunk on Dark Lord. The empty bottles of stout sat on her father's desk, and the computer exposed the last of her voyeuristic attempt to discover what her father had learned about Angela Mitchell before his death. If he had found anything at all, he didn't put it onto his computer. She cleared the bottles from the desk, sat again in the chair where her father had died, and used her phone to find the websites of 3 moving companies, the numbers of which she jotted on a sticky note. There were a number of storage facilities in the area, and she picked a few at random. She spent 30 minutes making calls and arranging times. When she was finished, she shut down the computer and looked around the room. Her father's office appeared different in the morning light than it had in the dark hours of the previous night. She noticed the cabinet door at the bottom of the desk was opened a crack, and saw the knob to a safe peeking from the crevice between the edge of the door and the frame of the desk. Rory pulled the door open. The safe was built into the desk, and she immediately spun the dial, trying common combinations of numbers. They all failed. She spun through her birth date, then her mother's and father's. When she finally tried her parents' wedding anniversary, the door swung open. Crouching down below the desk, Rory peered into the vault of the small safe. A thick folder sat on the shelf. She retrieved it and placed it on the desk. She opened the cover and found Thomas Mitchell's parole letters dating back 2 decades, all marked denied. Her father's appeal letters were attached to each denial. When Rory made it to the bottom of the stack, she found a letter from the parole board that suggested great progress by Frank Moore's client, and a changing in the board members' thinking. 2 more letters praised the evolution and rehabilitation of Thomas Mitchell, and then, at the bottom of the stack, the parole letter marked approved. Rory paged back through the stack, glancing at the dates on top of each letter, her mind registering and cataloging each month, day, and year. Her father had been part of all of the hearings and appeals dating back to the 1980s. She stacked the appeal letters and parole board correspondence to the side. The next stack of papers was handwritten letters from Thomas Mitchell. The penmanship was perfect block, all caps letters that looked as though they were traced from the print of an old-fashioned typewriter. Rory recalled the detective's chicken scratch from the many reports she had read throughout her career. Thomas Mitchell's writing was in stark contrast, evidence of a man with nothing but time in front of him. There was no urgency to his work. There was no reason to rush. His writing was deliberate, each letter a perfect match to the one preceding it. As Rory skimmed the page, she noticed the repetitive way the man composed his A's. He used no crosshatch, and the letter looked simply like an inverted V. The character jumped from the page in every word where it was present. "I, Thomas Mitchell, elect my attorney, Frank Moore, to be present and to speak on my behalf on the matter of my latest parole hearing." The unique symbol gave Rory a nauseous feeling, as if the missing crosshatch represented a sinister deletion of something more significant in the man's soul. She pushed the letters to the side and pulled the last pile of papers in front of her. The stack was a rubber-banded collection on top of which was her father's writing, Angela Mitchell. Rory's breath caught in her throat. Chronicled in the pages was what appeared to be her father's research into the life of Angela Mitchell, her family, friends, and acquaintances. A long list of names with check marks and notes next to each one. She recognized Catherine Blackwell's name. She moved her finger down the page, reading each name. "Your friend said I might find you here." The voice startled her, and the breath Rory held in her throat came out with a yelp. She looked up to see Celia standing in the doorway. Rory put her hand over her chest. "Christ, Celia, you scared the hell out of me."
"Sorry. I knocked. No one answered. But I saw your car outside."
Rory stacked the papers together. "What are you doing here, Celia?"
"You never called me back. I went to your house this morning. Your friend said to look for you here."
Rory vaguely remembered a drunken call to Lane the night before while she snooped through her father's computer.
Sorry, Rory said. I've just had so much going on.
Rory recognized something in Celia's expression.
Is something the matter?
I'm afraid your father has left me with a burden I can't handle, Celia said, holding a small object in her hand. He gave me this a long time ago. Told me to keep it to myself. Rory squinted her eyes. Her contact lenses were dry from having slept in them, and she couldn't make out the object in Celia's hand.
What is it?
It's the key to his safe deposit box. Chicago, November 1981. Frank stopped his car at the edge of the long driveway. The farmhouse stood in the distance. It was late afternoon, and the shadows of maple trees stretched across the property. He turned the wheel and advanced up the extended drive. The dogs appeared from behind the house to chase his car, hopping at the excitement of a visitor. Frank worried that they would sense his fear from the last time he was here, when he had barely made it to the safety of his car as they tried to rip him to shreds. He wasn't about to open the door, but he shut off the engine and waited while the dogs barked and announced his presence. After a minute, the woman appeared on the front porch and shouted at the dogs, and they promptly ran to the back of the house. Frank stood slowly from his car.
"Come on inside," the woman said.
Frank walked up the steps and onto the creaky front porch. The woman opened the screen door, and Frank followed her inside. They entered the sitting room off the foyer. A large bay window looked out over the fields behind the property. The woman appeared older, now that Frank had a good look at her, perhaps a bit haggard, as if life had treated her badly. She ran a hand through her coarse gray hair as she sat on the sofa. Frank was prepared for small talk, but didn't need to be. He had his story prepared, but wouldn't use it.
"Why are you asking about Angela?"
The directness of the question caught Frank by surprise, and he felt the sudden need to tell the truth. For months he'd lied about what he was doing. For months he'd been deceptive as he tried to find any useful thread that might lead to the whereabouts of a woman he was rapidly believing might be alive. But for some unexplained reason, the woman in front of him now seemed as though she'd be impervious to his stories.
"I've been hired to see if Angela is..."
Frank struggled with his words for a moment.
"Is what?"
"Is still alive."
The woman shook her head. "She warned me that he'd come looking for her." A tremble went through him, a buzzing deep in his soul.
"Who warned you?"
The woman looked at him, a dead stare that was unrelenting.
"Angela."
Frank felt as though he were falling. The air drained from his lungs, and when he spoke again, his voice was soft and weak.
"She warned you that who would come looking for her?"
The woman's voice was equally frail when she answered, "Thomas." "She said he'd never stop looking for her." Chapter 25. Chicago, October 30th, 2019.
"Where did you find it?" Rory asked, looking at the key in Celia's hand.
Rory had been through every square inch of her father's law office. It was empty.
"I loved your father," Celia said, in a voice congested from crying. "We loved each other, Rory. We didn't tell you because Frank thought you'd be upset that we were together."
Rory sat up in the chair, reached to adjust her glasses before realizing they were on the coffee table next to the couch where she had slept. Her beanie hat was there, too. As she stood from her father's chair, she did so barefoot, her combat boots in a heap next to the table. All Rory's protective gear was gone as she listened to Celia confess to a relationship with her father.
It was a year or so after your mother passed. Frank worried that you'd think we were together before that, but we never were, Rory. I would never do that. Your father was so sad after Marla passed. My own husband had died years before, and we just found each other and fell in love.
Okay, Rory said, holding up her hands. I don't really want to know any more, Celia. Not right now. Her head ached from too much Dark Lord, but through the pounding, Rory pieced things together. The relationship explained Celia's wild emotions at the funeral, and her near-debilitating, tear-dripping embrace when Rory met her to start the process of dissolving the law office. A profound sadness came over her as Rory considered the last few years of her father's life. He had gone through a deep and agonizing depression after Rory's mother had passed. And during the last year, Rory had sensed that her father had been overly stressed. Perhaps it was because he had found happiness with another woman, but couldn't share his newfound joy with his daughter. Rory had always been his to protect, and her father had gone to great lengths throughout his life to make sure Rory was never hurt by anything he did. Now Rory had discovered a part of his life she wished she could have enjoyed with him. The crying she worked so hard to prevent last night nearly came to her now, before she managed to stop her eyes from welling with tears. I'm sorry to tell you this way, Rory. I've struggled with it ever since Frank died. I even thought about never telling you. And perhaps that would have been the easiest solution, except for this. Celia walked over and pushed the key across the desk. Your father had a safe deposit box. He told me that if anything ever happened to him, I was supposed to take what was in the box and keep it to myself. Rory composed herself, picked up the key.
What's in it?
I have no idea. I think money, but I don't feel right keeping it. Frank promised that he'd always take care of me. You know, financially. But if he left money behind, it belongs to you.
Rory picked up the key and ran her fingers over the grooves on the blade. An eerie feeling ran up her sternum and through her neck to cause her ears to ring. The hair follicles on her head tingled. She looked at the stack of papers she had just discovered in her father's safe and knew it was not money he wanted Celia to hide. Rory parked her car in the bank's parking lot just before 9 o'clock. Celia sat next to her in the passenger seat. The Dark Lord headache still gripped her temples and her mouth was cotton dry. She was adorned in her protective armor, hat, glasses, gray jacket, and Madden Girl Elwaze combat boots. On the ride over from her father's house, Celia explained that a year after they started dating, Frank had asked her to sign papers that put her on the safe deposit box as a registered holder. Celia had never asked about the contents of the box. She only knew that it caused Frank much distress when he asked Celia to watch over them. As they waited in the car, Rory took a quick sideways glance through the edge of her glasses and noticed Celia staring at her. The woman was anxious to talk about her relationship with Rory's father. Rory was anxious for a Diet Coke and some privacy. Mercifully, a bank employee unlocked the front doors just as the car's digital clock blinked to 9 o'clock a.m. Rory pointed through the windshield. Bank's open. They each climbed from the car and made it across the lot. Inside, they rode the elevator to the bottom floor and approached the reception desk. A woman smiled at them. Rory allowed Celia to take the lead.
We need access to box 411.
Are you both registered holders? The woman asked.
No, Celia said. Just me.
Only registered holders are allowed into the vault, but you're welcome to wait in the reception area just outside.
That's perfect, Rory said. Thank you. Celia handed over her ID and signed a card. The bank employee made a copy, checked Celia's signature to the one on file, and retrieved the master key from a locked cabinet on the back wall. The woman disappeared briefly as she walked around the corner, then opened the door to where Celia and Rory waited.
"Right this way," the woman said.
They walked to the other side of the floor, where thick metal bars separated the reception area from the vault of safe deposit boxes. The gate had been opened earlier in the morning, as had the vault door beyond. The woman pointed to a waiting area with tall, round tables. Rory walked over and watched Celia walk with the woman past the gates and into the vault. A few minutes later, Celia reappeared with a thin metal box in her hands. The woman smiled.
"Let me know when you're finished."
Celia placed the box onto the surface of the tall table.
"I'll leave you alone," she said to Rory.
Rory nodded, kept her gaze on the box. When she was alone in the room, she lifted the lid and stared at the contents. There were just a few pages inside. She lifted the first packet, which was her father's last will and testament. She turned the pages slowly, found nothing out of sorts, and placed it to the side. When she examined the next document in the box, the room began spinning. Slowly at first, but faster with each passing moment. She placed her hands on the table to steady herself as she lifted the page and read it. The room rotated with such ferocity that Rory reached for her temple as she studied the page, knocking her glasses to the floor. She took the last article from the bottom of the box, another single document, stumbled backward until she collided with the wall. Her beanie hat fell from her sweaty scalp, and she sunk to the floor as she read. Chicago, November 1981.
"Angela warned you that her husband would come looking for her?"
Frank asked. The woman stayed silent.
"Angela is alive?"
Margaret looked away from him, out the window, and to the vast expanse of land behind the house.
"How did you find me?"
Frank accepted the dodge without pushback. He knew he was on the cusp of a monumental discovery.
"You were listed on the Bear Group's log as the one who picked Angela up on her 18th birthday when she left the psychiatric hospital."
"Damn it," she said.
"We thought long and hard about any trail that might lead to me, anything that might link us to one another. We thought we were safe."
She pulled her gaze from the windows.
"So now I know how you found me, but I need to know why you're looking. Did he send you?"
Frank swallowed hard. A sinister sense of dread hung in the room, and his connection to Thomas Mitchell never felt so wrong.
"There are some people who believe Angela is still alive, that she disappeared to get away from her husband. The police were convinced he killed her, and the district attorney mounted a good enough case to convict him. But I'm wondering if they were all wrong."
"Did he send you?" she asked again. He felt a seismic shift in what he was trying to accomplish. His journey had been set to help his client, but now he felt as though he were putting lives at risk. Frank nodded.
"Yes,"
he finally said.
"Thomas Mitchell hired me to find his wife."
The woman's eyes widened with fear.
"You mustn't ever tell him what you've discovered. Do you understand? He must never find me." "Were they wrong?"
Frank asked.
"Were the police and the prosecution wrong? Did Thomas Mitchell kill his wife?"
"No," Margaret said.
"But he killed so many other women." "Where is Angela?"
He killed all those women, just like she said. And she told me he would come looking for her. She told me he'd hire people to find her. It took 2 years, but Angela was correct.
Frank kept to himself that he had already discussed this lead with his client, something he now regretted. Some part of him felt that doing so was a grave mistake.
"Tell me what happened,"
he said.
"I can help you. If you need help, I promise I'll find a way."
From another room, far off in the farmhouse, there was a squeal. Frank looked out into the hallway when he heard it. It came again and again, louder and louder, crying.
"Come with me," the woman said.
She stood from the couch, walked into the foyer, and started up the stairs. Frank noticed the perspiration beading down from his temples. He followed the woman to the base of the stairs. An odd premonition came over him that if he continued up the staircase, his life would never be the same. But the lure of Angela Mitchell, the ghost he had been chasing, was too great to prevent his steps. He heard the floorboards creak under his feet as he followed the woman up the stairs. With each stride, the cries grew louder. More than cries now, they were shrieks. At the top of the landing, the gray-haired woman turned and entered a room. Frank paused when he reached the last step, then looked down the long staircase he had just ascended. The wooden railing and the rungs within it blurred in his vision. The foyer below and the front door and the dying afternoon sunlight pouring through the window all swirled together in a distorted image. He still had time. The opportunity was still in front of him. He could race down the stairs and to his car. He could drive away from this farmhouse and never come back. He could tell his client it was a dead end. He could lie. In the end, though, he didn't run. Instead, he turned and walked to the open doorway through which the woman had disappeared. A baby carriage stood in the corner. The small child standing in the crib, red-faced and angry, was the source of the crying. The screams were so visceral now that Frank had the urge to cover his ears, but curiosity pulled him into the room. When he walked through the threshold, the cries subsided as the gray-haired woman lifted the baby into her arms. As Frank entered the room, a strange sensation came over him. It felt as though 1,000 sets of eyes were watching him. Then he realized why. 3 of the 4 walls in the nursery contained built-in shelves. Each shelf was lined with antique china dolls in perfect rows, 3 on each shelf. They looked immaculate as they glowed under the lighting with their unblinking eyes focused on him. "He mustn't ever find her," the woman said. Part 3. The Farmhouse. Chicago, May 1982. Frank Moore turned his car onto the country road and accelerated down the long stretch of 2-lane highway flanked by freshly planted cornfields. His wife sat next to him in the passenger seat. The sun was behind them this Saturday morning and cast a slanted shadow of their car onto the road in front of them. It had rained for most of the month of April, but so far May was doing a splendid job of ushering spring along, bringing sunshine and flowers. For Frank and Marla Moore, the season brought hope as well.
"How did you find this family?" Marla asked.
"It's a long story," Frank said, "but I've been searching since we heard the wait list was so long. I received a phone call last week."
"You met them without me?"
"Just to make sure it was legitimate. You've been through so much already with..."
Frank's voice trailed off. He wanted to avoid talking about the miscarriages. They always sent Marla into bouts of depression, and today was meant to be a joyous day, even if it was filled with deceit.
I've heard stories of people being scammed for money when they don't go through a formal agency,
Frank said.
I wanted to make sure this was on the up and up before I got you excited.
Is it? Frank paused.
Yeah, it's legit.
You're sure about this? She asked. Frank looked at his wife.
I'm sure.
Frank saw Marla smile for the first time in months. An hour later, they pulled to the edge of the farmhouse. A waist-high, white-painted wooden fence surrounded the property and went on for acres.
Are you ready?
He asked. Is this real? Frank nodded his head slowly.
It is.
He turned into the driveway and coasted along the gravel until he stopped the car in the same spot he always did. 6 months had passed since the first time he came to this house. He'd lost count of the number of visits he'd made since he first stumbled onto his discovery. He wished he had more time to figure it all out. But no matter how long he waited, the blueprint of their plan would never be perfect. It would be dangerous. It might even be disastrous. But perfect? Not a chance in hell. He'd never kept a secret from Marla in the short few years that they had been married, and he'd gone into his relationship with the idea of never keeping anything from her. But life sometimes delivers unforeseen opportunities, unexpected callings that make certain transgressions palatable in the grand scheme of it all, when life asks of you more than you ever thought you could give. The dogs knew him now. They were playful and relaxed as they hopped next to him as he walked to the porch with his wife's hand in his own. The door opened and the woman smiled.
Marla?
Frank's wife swallowed hard and nodded.
Margaret?
Oh, dear, no. No one but my grandmother ever called me Margaret. Please call me Greta.
She pushed the screen door open.
Come on in. I can't wait for you to meet her.
Chapter 26. Chicago, October 30th, 2019. Rory carried the Kestner doll into the nursing home. She found Greta sitting in her chair. It was the first time in weeks since before her father had died Rory had seen her out of bed. A strange feeling washed over her when she stared at her aunt. A lifetime of memories flashed in her mind. Images of long weekends spent at the farmhouse, passing the days restoring the china dolls with Greta. The satisfaction Rory felt when Greta allowed her to place a finished doll on the shelf in the room upstairs was like nothing else she had ever experienced. An obsessive-compulsive disorder, diagnosed when Rory was 6 years old, had threatened her childhood. But somehow, in the room upstairs at Aunt Greta's farmhouse, Rory was able to tend to the needs of her mind. Working on the dolls purged all the tenuous demands of her brain. Rory's habits and the mandate for perfection not only went by without judgment or worry when she worked with her aunt, but the time Rory spent in that room upstairs demanded all the redundant and meticulous acts that were an unwanted nuisance during the rest of her life. As soon as Rory discovered this outlet, the rest of her days were untouched by the requests of her mind. In adulthood, Rory began her own collection and applied to it the craft Greta had taught her. When Greta's health began to fail, she made it clear that the upstairs room in the farmhouse belonged to Rory, and that she alone was in charge of watching over the collection. Those dolls now lined the shelves in Rory's den. But her childhood felt different now. Nothing seemed the same since Rory had opened that safe deposit box to find a birth certificate listing Greta as her birth mother and documents showing Frank and Marla Moore as her adoptive parents. Rory understood so little and wanted so many answers. "Hey, old lady," Rory said. Greta glanced at Rory before looking back at the muted television.
"I tried to save you," There was too much blood.
Rory took a deep breath, angry with herself for the sudden frustration she felt toward Greta. A moment of pause reminded Rory that Greta could no more control the random thoughts that popped into her mind and were spewed from her mouth than Rory could control a sneeze.
He's coming. You told me, but there's too much blood.
Okay, Rory said. It's okay.
He'll come for you, but we have to stop the bleeding.
Rory closed her eyes briefly. She hadn't asked anything of Greta for many years. In fact, their roles had been reversed over the course of their lives. Greta, once the caretaker who settled Rory's anxiety, was now the patient, and it was Rory who calmed her great aunt during bouts of unrest such as this. The fact that Rory wanted answers tonight that only Greta could provide was not an excuse to abandon her when she was in distress. Rory took a cleansing breath and walked to the side of the chair. She knew the best remedy for Greta's turmoil. It was the same one that had saved Rory as a child. "We've got to finish this Kestner," Rory said. "The owner is getting impatient. You promised me one more coat would do it." Greta blinked at the sight of the doll, as if the Kestner pulled her across the years, away from the tortured memories of the past and back to the present. She gestured for the doll. Rory kept her eyes on the woman she had known as her great aunt for her entire life, up until her dead father's lover had given her a key to a safe deposit box that told her otherwise. She eventually took Camille Bird's Kestner doll out of the box and laid it carefully on Greta's lap. From the closet, Rory wheeled the art kit she had brought a few nights before, set the pastel paints on the rolling table, and pulled it over to Greta's side. "In sunlight," Rory said, pointing to the doll's left cheek. "The hues match perfectly. But incandescent brings out the flaws, and fluorescent bleaches it out."
"One more coat," Greta said. "And I'll polish the undamaged side to bring it all together."
Rory sat on the edge of the bed and watched her work. The sight of Greta restoring a doll transported Rory back to the farmhouse, to the long summer days and quiet nights. She spent every summer of her childhood at Greta's place. During the school year, if a bout of obsession took hold of her, Rory's parents would pull her from school early on Friday for a long weekend at the farmhouse. There was no better remedy for her OCD and anxiety than a visit to the country and the restorations that waited there. Now, as Rory sat staring at Greta, the relaxed feelings she usually experienced while restoring a doll were replaced instead with thousands of questions.
"Are you working?"
Greta asked, pulling Rory back from her thoughts. "Yes," she said.
"Tell me."
Rory paused. She hadn't had a meaningful conversation with Greta in weeks. Tonight, though, presented a rare window of lucidity, where her aunt was interactive and coherent. "That Kestner. It belongs to a dead girl." The brush in Greta's hand stopped. She looked at Rory. "She was killed last year. Her father asked me to look into it."
"What happened to her?"
Rory blinked several times, aware again of how badly she had neglected the case. A small part of her was concerned that Ron Davidson would be disappointed in her. A bigger part worried about Walter Byrd, who had put his faith in Rory to find justice for his daughter. But mostly, Rory's heart ached for Camille Byrd, whose spirit waited for Rory to come for it, find it, and help it to a place of proper rest. Take it from its frozen grave in Grant Park and lay it carefully where it belonged, so the girl could find peace. Rory remembered another dream she'd had about the dead girl, of walking through Grant Park and trying unsuccessfully to wake her as Rory shook Camille's cold shoulder as she lay lifeless on the grassy knoll. Rory refocused her eyes, returning from the wandering abyss of her thoughts. Greta was staring at her.
I don't know yet.
Greta stared at her for a minute, then went back to work. An hour later, Greta finished polishing and coloring the cheek and forehead. She dusted the face one last time until the Kestner doll, once damaged and in disrepair, looked flawless.
Greta, Rory said, it's absolutely perfect.
She remembered the deep fissure that had run through the left eye socket when she first examined the doll at the library. When Rory laid the doll horizontally, the left eye closed in perfect unison with the right. The cheeks matched one another, and the fracture that had started at the hairline and run down to the chin was gone.
As close as we'll get. The girl's father will be happy with what you've done.
What you've done as well.
Greta looked back to the doll. Rory watched her, concerned that she had suddenly fallen into a lost moment and that her mind would be gone for the rest of the visit. The abrupt changes in demeanor happened so often now that Rory was no longer shocked by them. Greta, present and alert one moment, gone the next. But instead of staring off into a void of dementia, Greta spoke as she examined the doll.
It reminds me of when you were young, Greta said.
Rory nodded.
Me too.
Greta smiled.
Sometimes those summers seem like yesterday.
Greta, Rory said, standing from the edge of the bed and moving closer. Why did my parents bring me to your place so often? Why did I spend every summer of my childhood at the farmhouse? A long stretch of silence followed before Greta pulled her gaze from the Kestner doll and looked at Rory.
You were a nervous child, but found peace at my house.
Rory couldn't argue this fact. All the anxiety that surrounded her days, the angst that rose like early morning fog off a lake, faded away when she was at Greta's farmhouse. But Rory now understood there was another reason for her time there. Was the time I spent with you an arrangement, Greta? Something you worked out with Frank and Marla? Greta blinked, but didn't answer. She brought her gaze back to the doll in her lap. I found the papers, Greta. Dad had a safe deposit box where he kept them. My birth certificate, the adoption papers. Rory stared at Aunt Greta for a full minute without talking, allowing the confession of her discovery to settle between them. She wanted to press for answers, wanted to hear the truth from the only person left living who could provide it. But Rory saw Greta's eyes retreating to that faraway place, perhaps intentionally. More likely, though, just the result of the small stretch of coherence having spent its worth before the dementia pulled Greta's mind back to oblivion. As she watched Greta, Rory sensed a longing from the woman she had known her whole life. A woman who had saved Rory's childhood from what might have been years of torment and ridicule. A woman she had always thought of as her great aunt, but whose identity now had been jumbled in Rory's perception, like a fully set dining table once perfect and ordered being tipped on its side. The pieces suddenly too muddled to sort. Rory saw it in her eyes, a sense of sorrow that the restoration of the Kestner doll was over. It had been a channel to the past, to the summers and weekends when a young girl developed a lifelong friendship and unbreakable bond with a middle-aged woman she knew as her aunt.
I wish I could have saved you as easily as Rory and I saved the dolls, Greta said,
her eyes now vacant and set on the television. I am Rory. She crouched next to the chair.
Greta, can you hear me?
Yes, we'll hide you. He'll come, like you said. I tried to save you, but there was too much blood.
Rory closed her eyes briefly. Greta was gone. The visit was over. She stood up, lifted the doll from Greta's lap, and carefully laid it in the box. Chicago, May 1982. Frank and Marla sat next to each other on the couch. The visitations had taken place every weekend for the past month, with Frank and Marla making the trips out to Peoria each Saturday and Sunday to spend the days at Greta Schreiber's farmhouse, getting to know the child. The girl was asleep now. Marla had just finished reading Goodnight Moon while the child lay in her arms. It was a ritual she was starting to love, Frank could see. Marla hadn't wanted to put the child down, and only released her when Greta suggested they talk about the future. Frank knew the first part of his plan was working. His wife was becoming emotionally attached to the little girl. It was a critical part of his strategy. The bedrock, in fact, that needed to be laid in order for it all to work. Now, as the child slept, Frank was about to present the proposal to his wife, the specifics of which, Frank was sure, would sound simultaneously too good to be true and too outrageous to be possible.
"For this to work," Frank said to Greta, "Marla needs to know everything. If we're going to pull this off, there can be no secrets. We'll help in any way possible. You have my word. I know much of the story, but not all of it. I want my wife to know everything. Please start from the beginning so we're all on the same page."
Greta nodded. Her hair seemed to have whitened a shade since Frank first stepped foot on the farmhouse property the previous fall. Clearly, the stress she was carrying on her shoulders was crushing her.
"I'm a nurse," Greta said.
She was speaking to Marla, as Frank had previously heard this portion of the story.
"I work for the hospital here in town as a midwife. I make house calls to assist patients who have chosen to undergo a more natural childbirth in the home. I also counsel young women at Bayer Group."
Frank turned to Marla.
"Bayer Group Juvenile Psychiatric Facility."
Frank watched Marla nod, as if any of this made sense to her. He knew her mind was fixated on the child and the possibility that she would be theirs.
"I work with the girls at Bayer Group who were pregnant or who had once been pregnant. I counsel them on what to expect. I've been doing it for many years, and it was during my time at Bayer Group that I met Angela. She was 17 then."
Marla looked away from the bassinet.
"Who?"
"Angela Mitchell,"
Frank said. Marla looked at her husband. Her eyes were squinted and her forehead wrinkled.
"The girl who was killed a few years ago?
The girl from the summer of 1979? Frank nodded.
"Yes."
Marla cocked her head.
"Your firm represents Thomas Mitchell," Marla said. "You're working on his appeals."
"Yes,"
Frank said, taking Marla's hand.
"I told you we needed to understand the full story before we move forward. That's why we're here."
Frank took a second to stare at his wife, making sure she was on board for what was about to transpire. Finally, she nodded. They both looked at Greta.
"Angela was at Bayer Group for several months when she was 17 years old. This was in 1967.
Greta shook her head.
"Hard to believe that was 15 years ago.
Whenever I went to Bayer Group to counsel my patients, I noticed this introverted girl off in the corner by herself. One day I approached her, not as a nurse or as a counselor, just out of concern. I was hoping to make this young woman feel not so alone." "Hi," Greta said, as she sat across from the quiet girl she always saw sitting alone.
The girl didn't look at her or acknowledge her presence in any way.
"I'm Greta. I'm a nurse here."
This caused the girl to glance quickly in her direction and then back to her lap.
I'm not taking the medication, the girl said. I don't care who you are or how nice you pretend to be.
Oh, I'm not a psychiatric nurse. I work with some of the girls here, talking with them about the future.
Greta leaned a little closer.
Are they giving you medication you don't want?
Yes, the girl said.
Greta looked around the rec room. The television was playing, and a couple of girls were on the couch in front of it. No one else was in the room.
What are they giving you? Maybe I could talk with someone?
The girl looked at her. Greta saw fear in her eyes and a glimmer of hope, too, at the idea that Greta may be able to help.
Lithium. All it does is make me sleep and cause wild dreams. Sometimes the dreams even come while I'm awake.
That's called hallucinating, and it's a common side effect of lithium.
Greta scooted her chair closer.
Have you told your doctor about it?
Yes, but he doesn't care. They just want me to sleep and stay sedated.
When you say they, who are you talking about?
My parents and the doctors.
The girl looked at Greta.
Will you help me? No one in here will help me.
Greta reached down and took the girl's hand. Greta felt her recoil, but after a moment the girl squeezed back.
What's your name, dear?
Angela.
I'm going to help you, Angela. I'll find a way to help you.
Chapter 27. Chicago, November 1st, 2019. Rory sat in her office with Camille Bird's photo looking down on her from the corkboard. On the desk in front of her were the documents she had recovered from her father's safe deposit box. She stared at the adoption papers until her vision blurred. Her mind was beginning to strain in the unhealthy way Rory always worked to avoid. The redundant considerations that prevented clear thinking had started to descend on her, and like a cornered animal, she fought back at them. She knew the consequences of succumbing to them. She pushed the torment aside and swiped the adoption papers to the floor. Then she went back to the pages she had found in her father's desk safe and rifled through the parole board's letters. She read through years of appeals made by her father when he was a young attorney with Garrison Ford, arguments that poked holes in the prosecution's case that her father argued was built solely on circumstantial evidence. She read her father's scathing description of Angela Mitchell as an over-medicated autistic woman who struggled socially and who did not have a firm grasp on reality. Rory tried to convince herself that the pages in front of her were merely her father's attempt to fulfill the oath he took to protect all those who sought his help. But something about the research told a different story. It was subtle, what was coming to the surface of her attention. Elusive enough that Rory was sure no one else would see it. There was a change in tone. Rory picked up on it as she read through her father's appeal letters. The tenor of the arguments changed throughout the years, even if the content and facts within the letters remained the same. Perhaps, Rory thought, after years of failure, her father had lost a bit of passion trying to defend Thomas Mitchell. Perhaps, after 2 decades of redundancy, he had given up hope that any appeal would make a difference. But Rory couldn't stop herself from thinking that maybe something else was happening. That perhaps her father's letters held a different motive. That maybe her father never wanted Thomas Mitchell out of jail. She poured another Dark Lord and continued to read. Chicago, May 1982. The child remained sleeping as Greta continued her story about Angela Mitchell and how the two had come to know each other. Frank and Marla Moore listened from the couch as Greta poured coffee. I slipped Angela my phone number that day we first met in the corner of the rec room at Bayer Group. She was alone in the world with no one, not even her parents, to turn to. I had to help her. I spoke with both her doctor and the director of Bayer Group. My boss at the hospital back then was close with the medical director over there, and with some pushing, I was able to get Angela's parents more involved and have the lithium stopped. It took a few weeks, and during the whole process I met regularly with Angela. Not in any formal manner, just as, I guess you'd call us friends. Greta sat on the couch and sipped her coffee. She looked at Frank. And that's how you found me, because of my friendship with Angela. When she turned 18, Bayer Group could no longer keep her unless she chose to stay. She did not. She called me to pick her up. I pressed her to contact her parents, but that relationship was too fractured to repair. So I obliged. She signed herself out of Bayer Group, but my name was on the log that day as the one who picked her up. The best I can tell, it was our only mistake. I brought Angela here to the farmhouse. She stayed for a year, working and saving money until she had enough to move on. When she was 19, she left for the city. That was 1968. She found a job and was managing on her own. She called every so often. Even called to tell me she had met a man, Greta said. Unfortunately, that man was Thomas Mitchell. She took another sip of coffee. Marla and Frank were sitting on the edge of the couch. Marla was listening intently, and Frank sensed that she was working to make the final connection.
So you and Angela stayed in touch? Frank asked to move the conversation along.
Not really, Greta said.
For a while, we did. For a few years, she'd call every once in a while to tell me how she was doing. She told me her parents had moved to St. Louis, that she had found a job, that she had her own apartment. I was very encouraging, and I always invited her out to the farmhouse if she wanted a visit. But then she met Thomas, and after that she stopped calling. Years went by, and I didn't hear a thing from her.
Greta paused again to sip her coffee. She replaced the cup on the saucer and looked back at Frank and Marla. Then, in the summer of 1979, I saw the news reports.
That Angela had disappeared? Marla asked.
Yes. My heart broke when I saw her face on the television. And when the news came out that her husband was the man responsible for all those missing women from that summer, I felt that I had failed Angela. I had worked so hard to help her when I first found her sitting at that table all alone at Bayer Group. We had become close during the year she spent here. But then I just let her leave. I let her walk off into the world. When I heard what happened to her, I was stricken with guilt that I hadn't done more to guide her life. For those 2 days, my heart ached in a way I'd never experienced.
For what 2 days? Marla asked.
Greta looked at Frank. He nodded. Frank Moore needed his wife to hear it all. Greta Schreiber sat at the workbench in the room upstairs. The wall shelves were decorated with porcelain china dolls arranged in perfect rows. She had started a new project 2 days before, just after news spread about the most recent events in Chicago. Angela, the girl she had befriended at Bayer Group years earlier, and who had spent an entire year at the farmhouse when she was 18 years old, had gone missing, and was suspected to be the latest victim of the man authorities called the thief. The startling revelation that this man was Angela's husband had sent Greta pacing the kitchen for the better part of the night. But now the damaged doll in front of her was providing the distraction she needed. The hairline fracture, which ran across the crown of the skull, down over the ear and to the base of the jaw, required just enough attention that for as long as she worked on it, she didn't think of the young girl she once knew. A noise pulled her concentration away from the restoration. She heard an automobile's wheels crunching over the gravel of the long driveway that led from the main road to the farmhouse. Greta stood from the workbench and walked over to the window, peeling the curtains to the side. She saw a silver sedan pulling slowly down the drive, a gray cloud of dust floating behind it. Tubbs and Harold barked and jumped alongside the approaching vehicle. She stayed at the window while she watched the car approach, and only when it stopped with no sign of the driver leaving the vehicle did Greta turn from the window and head down the stairs. A moment later, she opened the front door and walked onto the porch. The car was parked at the front of her lot, the driver sitting behind the wheel. The windshield reflected the blue sky and maple trees to prevent a clear look at the person behind the wheel. Greta waited until finally the driver's side door opened. A thin woman climbed from the car, a hooded sweatshirt drooping from her frail frame. She lifted both hands to her head and pulled the hood down. "Sweet Jesus," Greta said, bounding from the porch and down the steps. When she reached the woman, she hugged her tightly. The woman whispered,